They have a lot of nerve calling here.
Who was it? Elizabeth asked, trying to keep the worry out of her voice. For the last 2.5 years, she'd been waiting for Hastings to notice Calvin's boxes were missing.
The head of personnel, but don't worry, I told her to go to hell.
Her? Harriet shuffled through the messages.
Here it is, a Miss Frask.
Frask, isn't it, Hastings? Elizabeth said, relieved. Well, she was fired years ago. She typed sermons for Wakely.
Interesting, Harriet said. Well, she claimed she's head of personnel at Hastings.
Elizabeth frowned. She likes to kid. After Harriet's car pulled out of the driveway, Elizabeth poured herself a cup of coffee, then reached for the phone.
Miss Frask's office, Miss Finch speaking, said the voice.
Miss Frask's office? Elizabeth scoffed.
Excuse me, came the voice.
Elizabeth hesitated.
I'm sorry, she said, but who is this? Who is this? Demanded the voice.
Okay, okay, Elizabeth said. I'll play along. Elizabeth Zott, calling for Miss Frask.
Elizabeth Zott, the person on the other end said. Good one.
Is there a problem?
Elizabeth asked. It was the tone. The woman on the other end recognized it immediately.
Oh, she breathed. It is you. I'm so sorry. Miss Zott, I'm such a fan. It's an honor to connect to you. Please hold.
Zott,
came a voice a moment later.
About fucking time.
Hello, Frask, Elizabeth said, head of personnel at Hastings. Does Wakely know you're making crank calls?
Three things, Zott, Frask said briskly. One, love the article. I always knew I'd see you back on the cover of something. But there, stroke of genius. If you want to reach the choir, it only makes sense to go where they worship.
What?
Two, I love that housekeeper of yours.
Harriet is not a housekeeper.
The second I told her I was calling from Hastings, she told me to go to hell, made my day.
Frask.
Third, I need you to come in as soon as possible, as in today, in the next hour or so if you can swing it. Remember that fat cat investor? He's back.
Frask, Elizabeth sighed. You know I love a good joke, but...
Frask laughed.
You love a joke? Is that supposed to be a joke? No, Zott, listen. I'm back at Hastings. In fact, I'm top of the heap. That investor of yours saw the letter I wrote to Life and contacted me. I'll fill you in on the details later. I don't have time now. I'm cleaning house. God, I love to clean. Can you come or not? Also, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but can you bring the damn dog? The investor wants to meet him.
Harriet entered the law offices of Hansen & Hansen, her hands shaking. For the last 30 years, she'd confessed to her priest that her husband drank and cursed and never himself attended Mass, that he treated her as his own personal slave, that he called her names. And for the last 30 years, the priest had nodded, then explained that while divorce was out of the question, she still had lots of options. For example, she could pray to find ways to become a better wife. She could take a good look at herself and try to understand how she upset him. She could take more care with her appearance. That's why she'd subscribed to all those women's magazines, because they were Bibles of self-improvement, and they would show her what to do. But no matter what advice she followed, things between her and Mr. Sloan did not improve. Worse, sometimes the advice backfired. Like the time she'd gotten a perm, something the magazine claimed would make him sit up and take notice, but instead resulted in endless complaints about how terrible she smelled. But then Elizabeth Zott came into her life, and she finally realized that maybe what she needed wasn't new clothes or a different hairdo. Maybe what she needed was a career in magazines. Was there anyone in the world who knew more about magazines than she did? It wasn't possible. And to prove this point, she knew exactly where to start, with Roth's still unpublished article. In Harriet's opinion, Roth had made the classic error of article placement. He'd assumed only science magazines would be interested in a piece on women in science. Harriet knew that was wrong. She called him, prepared to present her case, but his answering service relayed that Roth was still in, what was it, Vietnam? So she submitted his article without his permission. Why not? If it was accepted, he'd thank her. If it wasn't, he wouldn't be any worse off than he was now. She took the package to the post office to weigh it, added a self-addressed stamped envelope to ensure a speedy reply, then performed 3 Hail Marys, 2 signs of the cross, took 1 deep breath, and dropped it in the slot. After 2 weeks without any response, she felt a twinge of worry. After 4 months, the burn of rejection. She tried to face facts. Maybe she didn't know magazines as well as she thought she did. Maybe no one wanted Harriet in her Roth article, just like no one wanted Elizabeth in her abiogenesis. Or maybe Mr. Sloane, unhappy with Harriet's newfound happiness, had decided to punish her in all new ways. Maybe he threw out her mail. Miss Zott, the Hastings receptionist swooned as Elizabeth entered the lobby. I'll let Miss Frask know you're here. She plugged a cable into the switchboard. She's here, the woman hissed to someone on the other end. Would you mind? She held out a copy of The Voyage of the Beagle. I just started night school. Love to, Elizabeth said, signing the cover. Good for you. It's because of you, Miss Zott, the young woman said earnestly. Also, if it's not too much to ask, could you also autograph my magazine? No, Elizabeth said. Life's dead to me. Oh, sorry, the young woman said. I don't read Life. I meant your latest one. She held out a thick, slick publication. Elizabeth looked down, shocked to see her face staring back at her. Why Their Minds Matter, read the cover of Vogue. As they clipped down the hallway, their heels in sharp contrast to the muffled sounds of generators and cooling fans coming from the other laboratories, Frask informed Elizabeth that they were meeting in Calvin's old lab. Why there? Elizabeth said.
The fat cat insisted.
It's a pleasure, Miss Zott, Wilson said, unfurling his long limbs from the stool. He reached his hand out as Elizabeth took inventory. Carefully cut gray hair, sage-colored eyes, pinstriped woolen suit. 632 gave him a thorough sniff, then turned to Elizabeth. All clear. I've been wanting to meet you for a very long time, Wilson was saying. We appreciate your willingness to come in on such short notice.
We? Elizabeth asked, surprised. He means me, a 50-ish woman said as she emerged from the lab supply cabinet with a clipboard. She had the kind of hair that had once been blonde but was slowly surrendering to age. Like Wilson, she also wore a suit, but hers was bright blue, and despite the careful tailoring, looked less serious thanks to a cheap daisy brooch pinned to her lapel. Avery Parker, she said nervously, gripping Elizabeth's hand. Pleasure. 6:30, having finished his investigation of Wilson, went to analyze Parker. He sniffed her leg. Hello, 6:30, she said. She bent over and pressed his head against her thigh. He took an exploratory sniff, then drew his head back in surprise. He probably smells my dog, she said, drawing him back in. Bingo's a huge fan of yours, she said, looking down at him. Loved your work on the show.
What a highly intelligent human being.
We'll be needing a full inventory from every lab, she said, turning to Frask. And we'll also need to know what you might need, Miss Zott, she said with a touch of deference. For your research. Your research here at Hastings, I mean.
To continue your work on abiogenesis, Wilson interjected. On your final show, you announced your intention to return to your research. What better place than here?
Elizabeth cocked her head to the side. I can think of several. The last time she'd been in this room, Frask was here too. Although at that time, Frask was informing her that Calvin's things were gone. 6:30 had to go, and Madeline was on the way. She took in the depressing chalkboard filled with someone else's writing, then looked back at Mr. Wilson. He was draped on Calvin's old stool like a bolt of fabric. I really don't want to waste your time, Elizabeth said. But I don't see myself returning to Hastings. It's personal. I can understand, Avery Parker said. After all that transpired here, who could blame you? Still, I'd like a chance to change your mind. Elizabeth looked around the lab, her eyes resting on one of Calvin's old signs. Keep out, it warned. I'm sorry, she said. You'll be wasting your breath. Avery Parker looked to Wilson, who in turn looked to Frask.
Why don't we have some coffee?
Frask said, jumping up.
I'll make a fresh pot, and while we're waiting, the Parker Foundation can fill you in on some of their plans.
But before she'd gone halfway across the room, the lab door swung open.
Wilson! Donati shouted as if greeting a long-lost friend. Just heard you were in town!
He rushed forward, his hand extended like an overeager salesman.
Dropped everything and came right over. Technically, I'm still on vacation, but...
He stopped abruptly, surprised to see a familiar face.
Miss Frask, he said, what are you...
Then he swiveled his head toward a frowny-looking older woman holding a clipboard, and just beyond her stood...
What the hell?
Elizabeth Zott. Hello, Dr. Donati, Avery said, extending her hand just as he dropped his. It's nice to finally put a face to the name.
I'm sorry, but you are...
he said condescendingly while trying to avoid looking at Zott the way one avoids a solar eclipse.
I'm Avery Parker, she said, pulling her hand back.
And when he continued to look confused, she added,
Parker, as in the Parker Foundation.
His lips parted in fear.
I'm sorry to learn we've interrupted your vacation, Dr. Donati, Avery said, but the good news is you're about to have plenty of free time.
Donati shook his head at her, then turned back to Wilson.
As I said, had I known you were coming...
But we didn't want you to know we were coming, Wilson explained genially. We wanted to surprise you. Or no, technically, I guess this is more of a blind side.
Excuse me?
Blind side, Wilson repeated. You know, like the way you blindsided us by misappropriating Parker Foundation funds, or the way you blindsided Miss Zott. Or should I say, Mr. Zott, when you stole her work?
Across the room, Elizabeth raised her eyebrows in surprise. Now look here, Donati said, jabbing a finger in Zott's general direction. I don't know what that woman told you, but I can assure you.
He stopped midway.
And why the hell are you here? He demanded, pointing at Frask. After those ridiculous lies you wrote in your petulant little letter to life. My lawyer wants to sue.
He turned to Wilson.
You're probably not aware, Wilson, but we fired Frask years ago. She's got an axe to grind.
She does, Wilson agreed. It's a sharp axe, too.
Exactly, Donati said.
I know, Wilson said, because I'm her lawyer.
Donati's eyes bulged.
Donati, Avery Parker said as she dug in a bag and pulled out a single sheet of paper. I hate to be rude, but we're short on time. All I need is a quick signature and then you're free to go.
She held out a document headed by two simple words, termination notice. Donati, speechless, stared down at the document, while Wilson explained that the Parker Foundation had recently acquired a majority share in Hastings. It was Frask's letter in Life magazine, Wilson said, that had prompted them to take a closer look, blah, 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 malfeasance, blah, 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 decided to take the whole place over, Donati could barely listen.
Wasn't this Calvin Evans's old lab?
From somewhere far off in the distance, he heard Wilson droning on about sloppy management, fake test results, plagiarism. God, he needed a drink.
We're making some cuts. Frask said.
What do you mean, we? Donati said, snapping back.
I'm making some cuts, Frask said.
You're a secretary, Donati exhaled, as if he were tired of this charade. Fired, remember?
Frask is our new head of personnel, Wilson informed him. We've asked her to find a new director of chemistry.
But I'm the head of chemistry, Donati reminded him.
We've decided to offer the job to someone else, Avery Parker said. She nodded at Elizabeth. Elizabeth, surprised, took a step back.
Out of the question, thundered Donati.
I wasn't really asking a question, Avery Parker said, the termination notice hanging limp in her hand. But if you'd like, we could leave your employment status up to someone who really knows your work. For the second time, she tilted her head in Elizabeth's direction. All eyes turned to Elizabeth, but she didn't seem to notice. She was already fixated on the sputtering Donati. Hands on hips, she leaned forward slightly, her eyes narrowed as if peering into a microscope. There were two beats of silence. Then she leaned back as if she'd seen enough.
Sorry, Donati, she said, handing him a pen. You're just not smart enough.
Chapter 43. Stillborn.
Very few people surprise me, Mrs. Parker, Elizabeth said as she watched Frask escort Donati out. But you have.
Avery Parker nodded.
Good. The offer's sincere. We hope you'll accept. And by the way, it's Miss Parker. I'm not married, actually, she added. I've never been married.
Nor have I, Elizabeth said.
Yes, Avery Parker said, her voice dropping an octave. I'm aware.
Elizabeth noted the change in timbre and felt an instant prick of irritation. Thanks to life, the entire world knew Madeline was born out of wedlock. And because of it, she heard that tone all the time.
I'm not sure how much you know about the Parker Foundation, Wilson began as he wandered around the lab, pausing briefly to read a description on a file folder.
I know your focus is scientific research, Elizabeth said, turning toward him, but that your roots were Catholic charities, churches, choirs, orphanages. She stopped dead, suddenly acutely aware of that last word. She looked at Wilson more closely.
Yes, our founders were devoted to Catholic causes. However, our mission is entirely secular. What we do is try to find the best people working on the most critical issues of the day.
He set aside the file folder in a way that communicated that it was definitely not one of them.
7 years ago, when we funded you, you were doing just that, a biogenesis. Whether you know it or not, Miss Zott, you're the reason we came to Hastings in the first place. You and Calvin Evans.
At the mention of Calvin's name, she felt her chest tighten.
Strange about Evans, isn't it? Wilson said. No one seems to have any idea what became of his work.
His casual words hit her like a cyclone. She pulled out a stool and sat down, watching as he poked around the lab like an archaeologist, examining a tiny corner of this or that as if it might lead to something much bigger below.
I know you've already made your position clear, he continued, but I thought you'd be interested to know we plan to upgrade a lot of the equipment.
He pointed to a shelf where an out-of-date distillation apparatus sat unused. As he raised his arm, a shiny cufflink peeked out from under his suit sleeve.
Like that, for instance. That thing looks like it hasn't been touched in years.
But Elizabeth had no reaction. She'd turned to stone. When Calvin was 10, he'd written about a tall, rich-looking man with shiny cufflinks who'd arrived at the boy's home in a fancy limo. He seemed to think it was because of this man that the home was given new science books, but instead of being glad for the reading material, Calvin was devastated.
I'm here even though I should not be, he'd scrawled, and I will never, ever forgive that man. Him. Never. Not as long as I live.
Mr. Wilson, she said, her voice wooden.
You say your foundation only funds secular projects.
Would that include education?
Education? Well, yes, of course, he said. We support several universities.
No, I mean, have you ever supplied a school with textbooks?
On occasion, but
what about an orphanage?
Wilson stopped short, surprised. His eyes darted to Parker. In her mind, Elizabeth saw Calvin's letter to Wakely.
I hate my father. I hope he's dead.
A Catholic boys' home, she clarified.
Again, Wilson looked to Parker.
In Sioux City, Iowa.
A thick silence fell, interrupted only by the sudden whoosh of an exhaust fan. Elizabeth stared at Wilson, her face unfriendly. It suddenly seemed clear. The job they were offering was a ruse. They were there for one reason and one reason only, to claim Calvin's work. The boxes. They knew about them. Maybe Frask had told them. Maybe they'd made an educated guess. In any case, Wilson and Parker had bought Hastings, legally. Calvin's work belonged to them. They were plying her with compliments and promises, hoping that would be enough to coax the boxes out of the woodwork. But if that didn't work, they still had one last card left to play. Calvin Evans had a blood relative.
Wilson, Parker said, her voice trembling, would you mind? I'd like to speak with Miss Zott alone.
No, Elizabeth said sharply. I have questions. I want the truth.
Parker looked at Wilson, her face deflated. It's all right, Wilson. I'll join you in a few minutes.
As the door latch closed, Elizabeth turned on Avery Parker.
I know what's going on here, she said. I know why you asked me here today.
We asked you here to offer you a job, Parker said. That was our only goal. We're longtime admirers of your work.
Elizabeth searched the woman's face for signs of deceit. Look, she said in a calmer voice, I don't have an issue with you. It's Wilson. How long have you known him?
We've worked together for nearly 30 years, so I'd say I know him very well.
Does he have children?
She gave Elizabeth a peculiar look. I'm not sure that's any of your business, she said. But no.
You're sure?
Of course I'm sure. He's my lawyer. This is my foundation, Miss Zott. But he's the face of it.
And why is that? Elizabeth pressed.
Avery Parker looked at her, unblinking. I'm amazed you have to ask. I may have considerable assets, but like most women in the world, my hands are tied. I can't even write a check unless Wilson co-signs.
How can that be? It's the Parker Foundation, Elizabeth pointed out, not the Wilson Foundation.
Parker snorted.
Yes, a foundation I inherited with the proviso that my husband make all the final decisions. As I was unmarried at the time, the board appointed Wilson as trustee. As I'm still unmarried, Wilson continues to hold the reins. You're not the only one who's fought a losing battle, Miss Zott, she said as she stood up, tugging hard on her suit jacket. Although I'm lucky, Wilson's a decent man.
She turned and walked away as Elizabeth asked another question. But instead of responding, Avery Parker ignored her.
What had she been thinking? Elizabeth Zott was not interested in returning to Hastings, and maybe, based on her pointed questions about Wilson, not to mention all the other issues, it would be better for all if she did not. Distracted, Avery reached up and touched her finger to her cheap daisy brooch. What a foolish woman she'd been, buying Hastings, coming here, meeting Zott. Yes, she'd always been fascinated by Zott and her research. She'd once dreamed of becoming a scientist herself. But instead she'd been raised to be one thing and one thing only, nice. Unfortunately, according to both her parents and the Catholic Church, she'd failed at that too.
Miss Parker, Elizabeth pressed.
Miss Zott, Avery returned just as emphatically. I've made a mistake. You don't want to come back to Hastings, fine. I'm not going to beg.
Elizabeth took a short breath in.
I've been begging my entire life, Parker continued. I'm sick of it.
Elizabeth brushed a few stray hairs aside.
It's not even me you want, she said hotly. Isn't that right? You're only here for the boxes.
Avery cocked her head as if she hadn't heard correctly.
Boxes? I understand. You bought Hastings. They belong to you. But this charade, what charade? I want to know about All Saints. I think I have a right to know.
Excuse me? Parker said. You have a right? Let me tell you a little secret about rights. They don't exist.
They do for the wealthy, Miss Parker, Elizabeth insisted. Tell me about Wilson. About Wilson and Calvin.
Avery Parker stared back, perplexed.
Wilson and Calvin? No, no. Again, I think I have a right to know.
Avery pressed her hands down on the counter.
I wasn't planning on doing this today.
Doing what?
I wanted to get to know you first, Avery continued. I think that's my right, to know who you are.
Elizabeth crossed her arms.
Excuse me?
Avery reached for the chalkboard eraser.
Look, I need to tell you a story. I'm not interested in stories.
It involves a 17-year-old girl, Avery Parker said, undeterred, who fell in love with a young man. It's a rather standard story, she said brittly.
where the young girl got pregnant and her prominent parents, shamed by their daughter's promiscuity, sent her away to a Catholic home for unwed mothers. She turned her back on Elizabeth. Maybe you've heard of these homes, Miss Zott. They're run like prisons, filled with young women in the same kind of trouble. They have their babies, then relinquish them. There was an official form to sign, and most signed. Those who refused were threatened. They'd have to endure the delivery alone. They might even die. Despite the warning, the 17-year-old girl still refused to sign, kept insisting she had rights. Parker paused, shaking her head as if she still couldn't believe the naivety. True to their word, when her labor started, they put her in a room by herself and locked the door. She stayed there alone, crying out in pain for a full day. At some point, the doctor, infuriated by the noise, finally decided he'd had enough. He went in and anesthetized her. When she came 2 hours later, she was given the grim news. Her baby had been stillborn. Shocked, she asked to see the body, but the doctor said they'd already disposed of it. Fast forward 10 years, Avery Parker continued, turning to face Elizabeth, her jaw tight. A nurse from the unwed mother's home contacts the now 27-year-old woman, wants money for the truth, tells her the baby didn't die, rather it, like all the other babies, had been put up for adoption. The only unusual thing, this child's adoptive parents died in a tragic accident. Then the child's aunt died. The child was sent to a place called All Saints in Iowa. Elizabeth froze. That was the day, Avery Parker said, her voice turning sad. The young woman began her quest to find her son. She paused. My son. Elizabeth drew back, all the color draining from her face. I'm Calvin Evans's biological mother, Avery Parker said, slowly, her gray eyes filling with tears. And with your permission, Miss Zott, I'd very much like to meet my granddaughter. Chapter 44. The Acorn. It was as if all the air had been sucked out of the room. Elizabeth stared at Avery Parker, uncertain how to proceed. This couldn't be true. Calvin's own diary had revealed that his biological mother had died in childbirth. Miss Parker, Elizabeth said carefully, as if picking her way across hot coals, a lot of people have tried to take advantage of Calvin over the years. Many have even pretended to be long-lost family members. Your story is... She stopped. She thought back to all the letters Calvin had kept. Sad mother. She'd written to him several times. If you knew he was in that boy's home, why didn't you go get him? I did, Avery Parker said. Or rather, I sent Wilson. I'm ashamed to admit I wasn't brave enough to go myself. She got up and walked the length of the work table. You need to understand, I'd long ago accepted that my child was dead. Now, to suddenly learn he was alive, I was afraid to get my hopes up. Like Calvin, I too have been a target for countless scams, including from dozens of people claiming to be my so-called relatives. So I sent Wilson, she repeated, looking down at the floor as if reviewing this decision for the 50th time. I sent him to All Saints the very next day. The vacuum pump started a new cycle, and with it a hissing sound filled the laboratory. And, Elizabeth prodded, and, Avery said, the bishop informed Wilson that Calvin was... She hesitated. Was what? Elizabeth urged. What? The older woman's face sagged. Dead. Elizabeth sat back floored. The home needed money. The bishop saw an opportunity. There was a memorial fund. Facts came pouring out of the woman in a dull, lifeless rush. Have you ever lost a family member? Avery suddenly asked in a flat voice. My brother. Illness? Suicide. Oh, God, she said. So you know what it is to feel responsible for someone's death. Elizabeth tensed. The words fit snugly, like laces knotted twice. But you didn't kill Calvin, she said with a heavy heart. No, Parker said in a voice sick with remorse. I did something much worse. I buried him. From the north side of the room, a timer beeped, and Elizabeth, trembling, went to shut it off. She turned to take in the woman standing at the chalkboard. She leaned to the right. 6:30 got up and went to Avery. He pressed his head against her thigh.
I know what it's like to fail a loved one.
My parents had long funded unwed mothers' homes and orphanages, Avery continued, fiddling with the eraser. They thought this made them good people. And yet, thanks to their blind allegiance to the Catholic Church, they managed to make an orphan out of my son, she paused. I funded my son's memorial before he was dead, Miss Zott, she said, with a breath shallow. I buried him twice. Elizabeth felt a sudden wave of nausea. After Wilson returned from the boys' home, Avery continued, I sank into a deep depression. I'd never had a chance to see my own son, never held him, never heard his voice. Worse, I had to live with the knowledge that he'd suffered. He'd lost me, then his parents. Then he ended up in that garbage dump of a boys' home. Each of these losses, signed, sealed, and delivered in the name of the church. She stopped abruptly, her face reddening. You don't believe in God for scientific reasons, Miss Zott, she suddenly exploded. Well, I don't believe in God for personal reasons. Elizabeth tried to speak, but nothing came out. The only decision I was able to make, Avery Parker said, trying to bring her voice back under control, was to ensure that all the memorial funds went toward a science education, biology, chemistry, physics, exercise, too. Calvin's father, his biological father, I mean, was an athlete, a rower. That's why the boys at All Saints learned to row. It was a gesture in his honor. Elizabeth saw Calvin. They were in the pear, his face lit by the early morning sun. He was smiling, one hand on the oar, the other reaching for her. That's how he got to Cambridge, she said as the vision slowly faded away. On a rowing scholarship. Avery dropped the eraser. I had no idea. Details slowly continued to fall into place, but something still nagged at Elizabeth. But how did you finally find out that Calvin... Chemistry today, Parker said, slipping onto the stool next to Elizabeth's. The one with Calvin on the cover. I still remember that day. Wilson came rushing into my office, waving it in the air. You won't believe this, he said. I picked up the phone right then and called the bishop. Naturally, he insisted it was only a coincidence. Evans, he said. It's a very common name. I knew he was lying and I intended to sue until Wilson convinced me the publicity would not only be ruinous for the foundation, but embarrassing for Calvin. She leaned back and took a deep breath before continuing. I cut off funding immediately. Then I wrote to Calvin several times. I explained things as best I could, asked to meet him, told him that I wanted to fund his research. I can only imagine what he thought, she said, depressed. Some lady writing to him out of the blue, claiming to be his mother. Or maybe I do because I never heard from him. Elizabeth started. The sad mother letters bloomed again before her eyes, the signature at the bottom of each radiating a sudden cruel clarity. Avery Parker. But surely, if you'd arranged a meeting, flown to California. Avery's face turned ashen. Look, it's one thing to pursue a child with vigor. But once that child reaches adulthood, it changes. I decided to move slowly, give him time to accept the possibility of me, research my foundation, realize I had no reason to delude him. I knew it might take years. I forced myself to be patient, but obviously, she said, given what happened. She fixed her gaze on a stack of notebooks. I was too patient. Oh, dear God, Elizabeth said, sinking her head in her hands. Still, Parker continued in a monotone, I followed his career. I thought maybe there'd be a chance, some way to help him, but as it turned out, he didn't need my help. You did. But how did you know Calvin and I were even together? A wistful smile pulled at the corners of her mouth. It was all anyone could talk about, Parker said. From the moment Wilson set foot in Hastings, all he heard were veiled references to Calvin Evans and his scandalous affair. It's one of the reasons why when Wilson told Donati he was there to fund a biogenesis, Donati did his very best to try to steer him elsewhere. The last thing he wanted was for Calvin or anyone associated with Calvin to succeed. And then there was the fact that you were female. Donati rightly assumed that most donors would not fund a woman.
But why would you, of all people, put up with that?
I'm almost ashamed to admit there was a part of me that enjoyed the position we put him in. He went to such great lengths to convince Wilson you were a man. But Wilson did have a plan to meet you without Donati's knowledge. In fact, he'd booked a flight. But then... Her voice trailed off.
What?
But then Calvin died, she said, and your work seemed to die with it.
Elizabeth looked as if she'd been slapped. Miss Parker, I was fired.
Avery Parker sighed. I know that now, thanks to Miss Frask, but at the time I thought you might be trying to move on. You and Calvin never married. I assumed the feelings between you and my son hadn't been mutual. Everyone said he was a very difficult man, that he held grudges. Obviously, I had no idea you were pregnant. You were quoted in the LA Times obituary as saying you barely knew him. She took a deep breath in. By the way, I was there, at his funeral.
Elizabeth's eyes widened.
Wilson and I stood a few gravesites over. I'd come to bury him for the final time and to speak with you, but before I could summon the courage, you left, walked away before the service was even over. She dropped her head in her hands, tears spilling. As much as I'd wanted to believe, someone had loved my son. With those words, Elizabeth slumped beneath the unrelenting burden of misunderstanding. I did love your son, Miss Parker, she cried, with all my heart. I still do. She glanced up at the lab where they'd first met, her face flattened by grief. Calvin Evans was the best thing that ever happened to me, she choked. He was the most brilliant, loving man, the kindest, the most interesting. She stopped. I'm not sure how else to explain it, she said, her voice beginning to break, except to say we had chemistry, actual chemistry, and it was no accident. And maybe it was finally using the word accident, but the crushing weight of what she'd lost overtook her, and she laid her head on Avery Parker's shoulder and sobbed in a way she never had before.
Chapter 45. Supper at 6. Within the lab, time seemed to stop. 6:30 lifted his head, watching the two women. The older one's arms surrounded Elizabeth like a protective cocoon. Elizabeth lost something she seemed to know by heart. Although he would never be a chemist, he was a dog. And as a dog, he knew a permanent bond when he saw one. I've spent the majority of my life not knowing what happened to my son, Parker said, holding a trembling Elizabeth close. I have no idea what his adoptive family was like. If the bishop's story was completely false or only partly true, I don't even know what brought him to Hastings. The truth is, I still know very little, she said. Or did until I checked the Foundation's P.O. box and found something unusual buried beneath months of junk mail. She reached down into her bag and took out a letter. Elizabeth recognized the handwriting immediately. Madeline. Your daughter wrote to Wilson and mentioned her family tree project, the one that appeared in Life. She insisted that her father had been raised in a boys' home in Sioux City. Somehow she knew Wilson had funded it. She wanted to thank him personally, tell him the Parker Foundation was on her tree. I thought it might be a crank letter, but she had so many details. Adoptions are usually sealed, Miss Sott. A heartless practice, but with Madeline's information, a private investigator was finally able to ferret out the truth. I have it all here. She reached back into her bag to withdraw a large folder. Look at this, Parker said, her voice defiant as she extended her own fake death certificate, payback for her non-cooperation at the unwed mother's home. This is how it all started. Elizabeth took the certificate in her hands. Madeline had once said Wakely believed some things needed to stay in the past because the past was the only place they made sense. And as it was so often with the things Wakely said, Elizabeth saw the wisdom in it. But there was one last thing she felt Calvin would have wanted her to ask. Miss Parker, Elizabeth said carefully, what became of Calvin's biological father? Avery Parker opened the file folder again, handing over yet another death certificate, although this one was real. He died of tuberculosis, she said, before Calvin was even born. I have a picture. She opened her billfold and extracted a weathered photograph. But he, Elizabeth gasped as she took in the young man standing next to a much younger Avery.
Looks exactly like Calvin. I know.
She slid a copy of the old Chemistry Today magazine out and placed it next to the photograph. The two women sat side by side as Calvin and his even younger father looked up at them from their separate histories.
What was he like?
Wild, Avery said. He was a musician, or wanted to be. We met by accident. He ran me over with his bike.
Were you hurt?
Yes, she said, luckily, because he lifted me up, put me on his handlebars, told me to hang on and rush me to a doctor. 10 stitches later, she said, pointing to an old scar on her forearm, we were in love. He gave me this brooch, she said, pointing to the lopsided daisy on her lapel. I still wear it every day. She glanced around at the lab. I'm sorry about meeting here. In hindsight, I realize this might have caused you some pain. I'm sorry. I just wanted to be in the room where... She stopped.
I understand, Elizabeth said. I really do, and I'm glad we're here together. This is where Calvin and I first met. Right over there, she said, pointing. I needed beakers, so I stole his.
That sounds very resourceful, Avery said. Was it love at first sight?
Not exactly, Elizabeth said, remembering how Calvin had demanded that her boss give him a call. But we ended up having our own happy accident. I'll tell you about it sometime.
I'd love to hear it, she said. I wish I could have known him. Perhaps through you I might.
She took a shaky breath and cleared her throat.
I would very much like to be a part of your family, Miss Zott, she said. I hope that's not too bold.
Please, call me Elizabeth. And you are a family, Avery. Madeline understood this a long time ago. It's not Wilson she put on the family tree. It's you.
I'm not sure what you mean.
You're the acorn.
Avery, her eyes a watery gray, took in some distant point across the room.
The fairy godmother acorn, she said to herself. Me.
From outside, they heard footsteps, then a quick knock. The lab door swung open and Wilson stepped back in.
I'm sorry to intrude, he said cautiously, but I wanted to make sure everything was...
It is, Avery Parker said. It finally is.
Thank God, he said, putting his hand to his chest. In that case, as much as I hate to bring up business, there's a lot that needs your attention, Avery, before we leave tomorrow.
I'll be right there.
You're leaving already? Elizabeth asked, surprised, as Wilson shut the door behind him.
I'm afraid I must, Avery said. As I mentioned earlier, I wasn't really planning on telling you any of this, not before we had a chance to get to know each other.
Then she added, hopefully, but we'll be back soon, I promise.
Well, let's say supper at 6, then,
Elizabeth said, not wanting her to go. The home lab, everyone, you, Wilson, Mad, 6:30, me, Harriet, Walter. You'll need to meet Wakely and Mason at some point, too. The whole family.
Avery Parker, her face suddenly familiar with Calvin's smile, turned back and took Elizabeth's hands in her own.
The whole family, she said.
As the door closed behind them, Elizabeth bent down and took 6:30's head in her hands.
Tell me, how soon did you know?
At 2:41, he wanted to say. Which is what I planned to call her.
But instead, he turned and jumped up on the opposite counter and grabbed a fresh notebook. Removing the pencil from her hair, she took it from him, then opened to the first page.
Abiogenesis, she said. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm Pandora Sykes, and I'm so excited to be speaking to Bonnie Garmus and asking her some questions about lessons in chemistry. Quick note that this will have spoilers, so don't listen to it before you've read the book. Bonnie, this is a book about Elizabeth Zott, a tenacious, quirky, resilient scientist and mother. What made you come up with the character of Elizabeth Zott, whose name I feel needs to be always said in full?
First, I'd just like to say it's a pleasure to be here. I'm a huge fan of yours, Pandora. So I would say, I always say Elizabeth Zott's name in full as well. So I'm really glad that you asked that question. I don't think she can just be Elizabeth, and she could never, ever be simply Miss Zot, because the latter, of course, defines her by her marital status, and she does not like that. Ms. didn't exist at the time, so Elizabeth Zot.
That's so interesting. Was it important that Elizabeth was an uncompromising heroine, as she has been frequently described?
Well, I think it was important that she be both rational and single-minded, dedicated to following her own path. She is seen as uncompromising, but really she's just unwilling to dumb herself down for society's convenience. Because of the way she was raised by religious charlatans, she has an unusually high need for common sense, for research, for the scientific method, for the intellectual pursuit of real answers.
And in her lab in the 1960s, Elizabeth is frequently undermined, sidelined, exploited, and even sexually assaulted. What kind of research did you do into workplace politics in the 60s and indeed the workplace politics of science in the 60s?
The hardest part of the book for me was researching the science, which I mostly did by using a chemistry textbook from the late 1950s. I'm not a chemist. It was far too easy to Google something and try to incorporate it, only then later realizing that part of the answer couldn't have possibly existed back then. As for the sexism and the workplace politics, I happened to have reread The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan right before I started the book. It was interesting to me because I suddenly realized Betty was writing about my mother's generation, and I can't begin to tell you how much that affected me, to read how depressed that particular generation of women was. And I began to think about my mom and all my mom's friends and what their ambitions might have been. As a kid, I don't think you really think about that too much. I had also read Marilyn French's book, The Women's Room, and that was a really important part of the feminist movement of the late 1970s. I also had some memories of my own from the 1960s. I was a young child, but I used to question why I couldn't join Little League when I could already hit and field better than most of the boys, why I couldn't have a paper route, why I couldn't be in the audiovisual club at school, which was all male, because as one teacher had told me, girls weren't good with things like film projectors. It was obvious to me at a very young age that boys had a lot more freedom and choice. I came from a family of four girls, and I wanted to know, what did these boys have that we didn't have?
Gosh, that's so interesting that you couldn't even be in the audiovisual club.
Yes.
And I mean, Betty Friedan's book, I agree, is that I read it again recently, and it's endlessly interesting of that specific Betty Draper Mad Men time of just that suburban, just think of the nails cracking on the side. And why did you choose to set it in the world of science? As you said yourself, you're not a chemist, and there's quite a lot of, the whole thing is imbued with science. It's Elizabeth's entire raison d'etre, really. She's obsessed. So you really immersed it in science. Why did you choose science rather than, say, your career before you were a writer?
I wanted to bring the idea of the scientific method to television. Television doesn't use the scientific method, and sometimes I wish they did. But I said it in the 60s, and I used science, and I combined those two things, particularly because that's, again, when my mom was a mother. My mother was a nurse. My father was a scientist. And I wanted to salute that generation of overlooked women and to highlight their enormous and often underused capabilities. I also wanted to do it then because I needed to remind myself that we have moved forward a little bit as a society. We're not equal yet, but we're better off than we were then. And I think also there's a large part of me that wishes the scientific method was used in everyday life. I think we as people would be making far better, more informed decisions based on discovery and facts instead of hyperbole.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then, of course, Elizabeth moves into telly, which is not an exact science and completely baffles her by sort of how chaotic it is, with Walter Pine, who turns out to be rather lovely. How did you conjure up that world? Did it feel more familiar to draw that, or were you back to the textbooks?
To tell you the truth, I watched a lot of television as a child, and I loved the Dick Van Dyke Show, and they would show you what television was like back then. So I used my memory of Dick Van Dyke to think about how these sets worked. As for Walter Pine, he's one of my most favorite characters, And I really love the fact that he was in television and he wasn't that good at it. He kind of knew he wasn't that good at it. He was an average Joe, and I think he was also a very poor decision maker. It was very important for me to make Walter human, a very good father, a good man, someone who forces himself to fit within the confines of a bossy male world. I think the problem overall with history is that we tend to paint it with a wide brush. So even back then, we could say all men were sexist, all men were predators, but they weren't. They weren't then, they're not now. I think back and I think about men, him in that position, he's being eclipsed by a woman, which must have been really hard. But I love the fact that he respected her, and it brought a certain tension to the book that I just desperately wanted to explore. And I especially love Walter's devotion to his child, who is not his biological child. He has a desire to defend and protect women, even though he's not very good at it.
I love the way you put that. He just keeps trying. Something I love about Elizabeth is that she comes across, I think maybe on an initial read, and certainly to lots of characters the first time they meet her, as prim. But actually, she just can't be bothered to engage in the ephemera of life. She resists Calvin because she has no interest in falling in love, particularly in the workplace. But when she realizes that there is chemistry at play, this undeniable science, she allows herself to give in to the romance because it's science. Can you tell me a little bit about the very unique and tender parallels that you drew between science and romance?
Well, Elizabeth doesn't relate very well to many people, and that's why she holds herself at arm's length. And it's partly because of science, but partly because she knows she's different, and she doesn't want to get hurt. She lost her brother. She's been dumped by her awful parents. She's very much of a misfit. She's cerebral. She's curious. She's independent, and she's determined. And unlike her mother, she is unwilling to rely on a man for financial support, which at that time in history, you pretty much had to do. As for the romance, that was probably one of the very best but also hardest things for me to write because I knew how it was going to end. Love, in fact, has a very strong chemical component. There's a reason we don't fall in love with just anyone. There are three actual basic chemical reactions that comprise love. And the first is very simple. It's estrogen and testosterone, the lust hormones. The second is attraction, which is the, I find this person to be interesting and fun. I feel good with when I'm with him or her. That's dopamine. The third is attachment, which is, I feel comforted and safe when I'm with this person. That's oxytocin and vasopressin. Calvin and Elizabeth had all three of those.
That's so interesting that it's always science. We just don't necessarily think of it in those terms. And a bit of a gear change, rowing is also a central metaphor in the book. A central activity in the book. I knew so little about rowing before I read this book. And it's a big part of how Calvin and Elizabeth fall in love. Not because Elizabeth is very into it, but Calvin is absolutely obsessed. Can you share a little bit more about the part that rowing played and how it operates within the story?
Well, I'm a rower. This is the one part of the book I did not have to research. That's probably one of the big reasons why it's in there. But actually, rowers are extremely obsessed about their sport, and they find it endlessly fascinating. Every time I would go rowing, afterwards, all the rowers in that boat would exchange emails all day about what went wrong at the 500, what went wrong at the 650, what the high 20 was like. It was just hilarious. I mean, this was our life. But in terms of rowing, I wanted it in there because rowing is a metaphor for balance. It's a metaphor for collaboration and cooperation. It's the art of working together, of recognizing our commonalities. And while those are strengths, for everyone, they're strengths, but in a boat, how well you cooperate with each other is the difference between winning and losing. It's not who's the biggest. It's who cooperates best with their teammates. Everyone rows as one, and that is hard. The oft-recited statistic by Elizabeth that we're 99.9% the same happens to be true, and it's also part of rowing. Things like systemic racism and misogyny and religious zealotry are divisive elements, and they're not based in science. They're cultural constructs, and they're usually used to control people, to keep some in charge and others under their thumbs. Imbalance in a boat spells failure. The same is true in everyday life. So when we choose to create situations dominated by one race, one gender, one religion, one outlook, we create imbalance. The result is havoc.
Can we briefly talk about the characters? Because your characters are so uniquely and quite unusually drawn. Let's start with 630. Who was the inspiration for him?
630 is the only character in the book based on a real living being. My past dog, Friday. Friday died a few years back. We had adopted Friday from the pound. She'd been horribly abused, so much so that her owner, her previous owner, was jailed. My kids named her for the best day of the week, they said. And she turned out to be this lovely dog who was basically Gandhi. She loved everything. She was very calm. She'd let our hamsters sit on her head. She used to babysit cats in the neighborhood. It's really true. And yes, she knew a lot of words. And we knew Friday was smart, but we didn't know how smart she was until we were transferred to Switzerland. And she picked up German. One day I jokingly said to her, "Freitag sitzen Sie." And boom, she sat down. And I thought, how is this possible? And she just looked at me like, you just have no clue. So that's where 630 came from.
I love that she babysat cats in the neighborhood.
We would often take our neighbor's pets in while they were on vacation. And she had a real fondness for cats. And we also had a rabbit. And she and the rabbit hung out together all day.
That's an Instagram meme.
Yes.
And Mads is like a Yoda, a sage. Is she partly meant to be kind of a superhuman child?
I think of her, Mad, as an observer. She's shy and she's too tall and she's got this weird background and she's too smart for school or her teacher. But she also has this mother who refuses to underestimate her child. So thanks to Elizabeth Zott, Mad is encouraged to explore her own interests like volcanoes and cannibals and knots. And she grows in ways other children can't. Elizabeth is one of those mothers who is certain she is not going to make the same mistake that her mother made. And that's why she puts Mad in school. She assumes that school will provide the social background that her daughter needs to succeed in life, the fitting in part. But this is where Elizabeth failed. Madeline doesn't fit in.
There's also Elizabeth's best friend, Harriet, who's such a source of comfort to her. And it's really heaven watching their friendship unfold. They both need each other desperately and are very different. And watching them come over that to realise what they can offer each other is wonderful. And you think it's almost not going to happen. And of course, her absolutely revolting boss, Donati, who's a joy to read just because he is so horrendous. One of my favourite characters is Miss Frask, who goes out of her way to sabotage Elizabeth Zott's career in the beginning in the lab, then becomes a close ally of hers when she realises her own internalised misogyny. Was she fun to write?
Oh, I love Frask. It was so easy for me to write her and to picture this woman who went out of her way to please her male bosses, only to learn the hard way that it was never going to work. I particularly loved writing the typing scene for some reason. It was her recognition of Mad as the only child that could have possibly come from a Zott-Evans union. But mostly I love Frask because she is an example of someone who's heard Elizabeth's messages and she puts them to direct use. As for Donati, he's awful, and yet I actually have empathy for him. He's raised in a society basically to be vile. And he wasn't allowed to follow his dreams either. He would have made a great bartender.
Elizabeth Zott was originally a character in a previous novel which you started but then abandoned. Can you tell us more about her character's journey in your mind and on the page? And what I always want to know when someone's written a wonderful book and they talk about oh, I came from this awful thing and it kept me up all night for 2 years and then I just left it behind us. I want to know what you left behind.
Okay. Well, like you said, Elizabeth Zott came from a previous book that I did not finish. That abandoned book opened with Madeline. She's grown up. She's about 30. She now has a small daughter of her own. And in that scene, she was meeting with a real estate agent, and they were looking at a rundown home with a dilapidated kitchen that Madeline was thinking of buying. And her 4-year-old daughter wanders off and discovers some books stashed in a corner, and one of them is a cookbook. And she takes it off the shelf and studies the woman on the cover, and she wonders why this woman looks familiar. And she attempts to sound out the words, just as Mad would have done when she was young. And she says, "Supper at 6. And Madeline across the room hears that and she freezes. And that was the opening scene of that book. And I never forgot Elizabeth Zott because she was on the cover of that book.
Interesting. So it was more a retelling of a, it's not a completely different story.
Well, it was actually the book centered on Madeline, and the character of Elizabeth Zott was one of the smaller themes in it.
Interesting. So when you started writing the new book, did this book very much start with Elizabeth? Did you know that she was the woman you wanted to tell the story? Although it's told obviously by lots of different people, it's still her story.
I had come home from work and I was in a terrible mood because I'd been in this meeting. I'd been dissed by some man. I mean, it was just, you know, the typical kind of sexist behavior. And for some reason, that particular incident really set me off. And I came home and I was sitting down. I was starting to work. And I literally thought there was someone else sitting there with me. And there was. It was Elizabeth Zott. And she said, "You think you've had a bad day? Well, get a load of this." And I sat and I wrote the first chapter. And that's exactly how it started.
I love that. Well, speaking of, because you said you sat down to work, listeners are always, and readers, are always fascinated by writers and their routines and habits. Can you describe a typical writing day for you? What does your routine look like?
I get up kind of early. Rowers get up early. So I'm up anywhere from 4:30 in the morning to 6. I'm usually up by then. I know.
Body.
Oh, it's sick. And I have a huge cup of coffee. And I do a crossword, usually the New York Times. And then I start writing. I write best in the morning. And then I stop around 9. And these days, in COVID times, my husband and I take our dog out for a long walk, hour or more, hour and a half. And then I come back and I reread everything I've done. And I start editing. Or I throw it all out and start over. And that's just pretty much how my day goes. I just sit and think about the story. I make little notes in a notebook. I think about plot points, but I think mostly about theme. And then the rest of the day, I take 99 out again for a walk at 3. My brain is fried by 4, and then I head to the gym and I erg. That is a very typical day for me.
Your dog is called 99?
99, yes.
This is great. I can see where 6:30 came from. How much of your own personal or professional experiences feed into the book?
Well, I don't think there are too many women on this planet who haven't run into sexism. And it's curious to me how many men think things for women have really improved. And yet, there aren't women in the world who can walk down a dark street without fear. They can't aspire to certain jobs. They still get paid less for the same work. Sexual assault is still extremely common and still usually goes unpunished. Women still aren't believed when they report these assaults. I constantly worry for women all over the world, for their safety and their rights as human beings. I have 2 daughters. This is really important to me. And I magnify this inequity by 10 for women of color. This really bothers me. We have all these problems to solve. We're losing our planet. We can't seem to control our technology. We allow religious paradigms to influence our policies. And meanwhile, in many parts of the world, we're keeping a very large portion of the population from contributing to their fullest. In China, they have a saying, "Women hold up half the sky." If the sky is falling, ask yourself why.
Wow, that's such an interesting saying. Well, on to the publishing process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not every day that a book receives the kind of reaction that yours did. Almost every publisher here in the UK and all over the world was trying to acquire it, and it's since been translated into 35 different languages, which is just huge for a debut. Can you, not just huge for a debut, huge for a book full stop, I don't think I've ever heard of that. Can you try and describe what those days and weeks were like for you as the auction process unfurled?
I was in a constant state of shock, and I think I'm still in that state of shock, to be honest. But during the auctions, I was so certain that I dreamed the whole thing that I'd get up in the middle of the night and check my computer just to make sure I hadn't dreamed it. And then one night, as I was getting up to do this yet again, my husband reached out for me and pulled me back down. And I remember him saying, "Let me save you the trip. It's real." And I don't know, that moment I thought was the very first moment I realized this was actually happening. My agent, Felicity Blunt, was absolutely incredible in helping me navigate and organize all of this interest. And I was so incredibly flattered and grateful to every single person I talked to. I couldn't believe the letters and emails and brownies and pencils and videos I'd get from everyone. And people just had so much to say about the book. And it was amazing to me to think all these people were connecting with it and saw it sometimes the way I did and sometimes in other ways that I hadn't, that I still loved. Anyway, that's what made the whole process also excruciating, because I kind of fell in love with everyone that I talked to. And after every phone call or after every Zoom, I'd turn to my husband. I'd say, "Oh, I'm definitely going with them. They were fantastic. They really got it." And I couldn't do that. So I relied heavily on Felicity and my other agent, Jennifer Joel, for advice and direction, and they were very, very helpful. But I will say, in the end, I do remember in the middle of the U.S. auction, Felicity, who I was talking to about 90,000 times a day by then, casually mentioned that there had already been interest from Hollywood. And I didn't think that was possible, because how could they possibly have the book? And so I didn't take her seriously. And it turned out I should have. And then I did a few days later.
Because, of course, the book is being turned into a series for Apple TV starring Brie Larson. How much involvement have you had in adapting it to the screen? Or have you just sat back and let other people take over?
It's really hard to just sit back. However, I'm extremely lucky to be working with such a talented team of people at Aggregate Films and Apple TV, and I trust them. I'm a huge believer in allowing other people's talents to take things forward and let them do their jobs. So I'm not working on the adaptation per se, but I'm in close contact with the main writer, Susanna Grant. And if you've never heard that name before, maybe you have, because, you know, she wrote Erin Brockovich.
No.
And Unbelievable. So she updates me with progress, and I'll soon be reading the scripts and offering my input. But, you know, I'm in excellent hands. And as a copywriter, I would always ask my clients to trust me, and I want to do the same with these people.
Wow, Erin Brockovich. Yes. I mean, that's a name drop.
I know.
Something I find really inspiring is that you've come to writing, and so very brilliantly as well, a little later in your career. Publishing, like many industries, is quick to prioritize and promote youth as an asset. Are you glad you've had this huge reaction? And I imagine a very big adjustment having this kind of response to your first book with a little bit more life under your belt.
Well, yes and no. I mean, in a way, I think it's really hard to be 30 and have these authors who've published something under 30, and then you start thinking, oh my God, I haven't done that, and I'm 30. And then you're 40, oh my gosh, I haven't done that, and I'm 40. I don't have to worry about that anymore. It's fantastic. But the fact is, I've been writing professionally for almost 30 years, more if you count the 2-page book I wrote when I was 5 and the 200-page book I wrote when I was 12. I'm a copywriter, and although my career has had plenty of ups and downs, I always approach copywriting as storytelling. That's actually why I was fairly successful at it. Copywriting is very brief, and it forces you to develop flow and tone, brevity, texture, humor. And I'm kind of in a big club of writers who are copywriters. Fitzgerald was one. Vonnegut was one. Heller, Rushdie, James Patterson. These were all copywriters. So although I always did want to write novels, that was my goal. And thanks to this book, I've now quit my day job and I'm in novels full time. And to say that I feel lucky is pretty much the understatement of the year. But I will say, as for the age part of it, it never occurred to me that age would matter. Authors aren't models and we're not athletes. Our skill set does not have to include speed or beauty. Thank God. And a lot of people never remember the author, so they're never going to remember my age. But I will say age has allowed me to write more tightly. And I think I see my characters more dimensionally than I would have at 20 or 30.
That's such a good bit of trivia about the writers who were also copywriters, and I'm definitely going to wheel that out. Well, speaking of speed, this is, I'm sure, a very annoying question because I think you probably deserve a little rest. But what can readers expect next from Bonnie Garmus?
Well, expect another novel. I'm
Good.
Working on something I love, and I still have to rewrite it another 49 times before I'll show it to my agent. Poor Felicity. But I do really think rewriting is where it all is. And so it will take me a while, but I will finish that.
It's been so wonderful speaking to you, Bonnie. And I just love Lessons in Chemistry. And chatting to you has made me want to go away and read it all over again, which is no bad thing.
Oh, thank you, Pandora. It's my honor to be sitting here with you today. So thanks so much.
We hope you've enjoyed this Penguin audio production of Lessons in Chemistry, written by Bonnie Garmus and read by Miranda Rayson. It was produced by Nicola Alexandru and Chris Sharp, and the post-production was by Red Apple Creative. Copyright and recording, Penguin Audio 2022. Text copyright, Bonnie Garmus 2022. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. For more Penguin audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.